Thank you, Abhinay, for all your kind words. I want to make it abundantly clear that what Abhinay said, my father would have loved to hear that, but only my mother would have believed it, you know. I need to be very clear on that. And I also need to be clear on a couple of other things. One, I have no major wisdom on matters about which I'm going to speak. Well, if you were to meet my better half, you should be more clear on this. There is no wisdom here. But I'm certainly wiser today than what I was yesterday. And so I share with you some experiences and some insights. And as time goes by, I cannot help but be wiser. That doesn't mean, as I said, I'm a wise man, but it's certainly nice to be wiser today than what I was yesterday. And I'll try and keep this talk short. The only thing that prevents me from not keeping it short is to avoid the question and answer session that you spoke about. So I'll have to draw a balance somewhere, and some of you who are in economics will help me optimize that. You know, this is about change. And we are all, I gather, all of us here are really from a university system. And university systems are not known to be very, very pro-change. Generally, they're conservative. It's something that I have learned over a long period of time. But that could be true of any organized setup which becomes a little large, a little too organized. It's not easy to get change in place. And of course, you could always ask, why should there be change? What is the need for change? If things are working all right, why have change? But we are not talking so much about a university system changing. That's not the point to be discussed. It is relevant, and it will have some relevance for what I will say. The point that I'm trying to make is university systems, to do well, to serve society, must consistently, constantly, persistently drive change. And how and why? I would love to share what little I understand about that. But then what is the role of a university? What does a university do, or what must it do? Well, that's simple. It must educate. But as Abhinay said, I'm a mathematician, and we mathematicians don't like proceeding unless we have set things right in terms of definitions. Of course, I'm not going to go to the board here, but I'll give you a definition of education. What is education? And in its simplest and most effective terms, it's meant for each individual. And what is this process of being educated? What is education? It's simply a look within. We delve within and try and hark to that drumbeat that resonates inside. Try and understand that and march in harmony with that drumbeat in the real world. And when you start doing that, then you can say you are now in the process of being educated. It's as simple as that, as far as I'm concerned. That's my definition. You may or may not agree with me, but I start with this axiomatic definition of education. So I repeat again, the whole thing is to look inside, discover who we are, find our calling in life. That's a drumbeat. March in the real world in harmony with that drumbeat, and you'll start getting educated. And a university's job, first and foremost, must be to ensure that anyone who comes to seek an education must be able to do that. And I am not saying this based on what little I have learned. Far greater people have said this in their own ways, time and again, time and again. And the thing is, sometimes I believe we in university systems may not be able to keep sight of that. There's been a very famous saint poet in India in medieval times. His name was Kabir. Kabir had no formal education, was illiterate. He was a weaver by profession. But he wrote some of the finest poetry that I have seen. Incidentally, as I said, he was a weaver, had no education, but in terms of literature and in terms of its spiritual heights that it attains, his poetry is extraordinary. And he said something very relevant in a couplet, which I will quote and then translate very quickly. Kasturi kundal basai mrig dhune van mahi, aise ghat ghat ram hai dunya dekhe nahi. What he says is that this musk deer wanders in the forest all around, enchanted by this fragrance, this sweet fragrance that fills its nostrils, trying to find the source of this fragrance, little realizing that its own navel is the source of the fragrance. That's where the musk resides. It doesn't know that, searches the whole forest. And in exactly the same way, Kabir says, we humans wander here and there trying to seek God, little realizing that the God that we are seeking resides within. We need to delve within. But then you could ask, what is that God? And let me try and bring it back to this business of education. So the God resides within, but what is God? Let me try and quickly define this. It's that which you believe in. Whatever your faith takes you to, that's your religion, which will elevate you to your God. Gandhi said it very clearly. He said that for the atheist, it's his atheism which is his religion. And that will take him to his God, whatever he believes in. So it's a question of this belief that comes from within. You catch hold of that, and then you live your life in harmony, in consonance with that belief. And so Kabir reinforces what I'm trying to tell you, or let me put it this way, I have put more crudely what Kabir has put in such a great fashion. And so universities, to my mind, must really do that. Each individual who approaches a university to be educated must go through this experience, this enabling experience, where he is allowed to delve within, taught to delve within, explore, figure out, and then march in the real world. And then you will realize something. It's a self-evident truth. That has very little to do with formal degrees. Very little. There's really hardly any correlation. Almost all the great people that I have admired in my life, from whom I may have learned a little bit to become a little better than what I am, have hardly had any university education. A short while ago, I was speaking to four extremely bright young undergraduates of your university. I spent a little time with them. And I asked each one of them, who do you admire the most in your life? And you'll be surprised. Each one of them named an individual who had had no college education. Each one of them. It's not a coincidence. We need to think about this. I have no idea to which university Jesus Christ went. I have no idea. I have no idea what formal degrees did he have. But if Christ wasn't educated, who was? That's what education is all about. You know, Christ reached within, conquered that divinity inside, and he became divine himself. That's what it is. You need to figure that out, and that's your religion. It takes you forward. It elevates you. As you move in the real world in harmony, like a yogi, in our tradition in India, then the yogi evolves and he becomes divine at some stage. That's what Christ was. But I don't know of any such qualification that he had. Or for that matter, the Buddha. He had no such qualification. I don't know what PhD the Buddha had. But if he wasn't educated, who wasn't? And the story goes on. There are all kinds of names. There was a person in India, whom Mahatma Gandhi, who is the father of our nation, Mahatma Gandhi called him a living God. His name was Ramakrishna Paramhans. He was the guru of Swami Vivekananda. Some of you may have heard of Vivekananda more than Ramakrishna Paramahansa. Gandhi called Paramahansa a living God. And what does this Paramahansa say about himself? He says, so long as I live, I learn. Paramahansa had no formal education. The father of the nation calls him a living God. And the living God says, so long as I live, I learn. So this process of being educated not only does not seem to have any correlation with the degree, it's a lifelong process. Only a few, like Christ or the Buddha, may in our reckoning have finished their education. Otherwise, for us ordinary folk, it's a lifelong process of evolution. We need to understand that. There are hallmarks. As a yogi evolves, there are certain hallmarks, certain characteristics, certain features that descend on the yogi. One of them is humility. It's very important. If that's not there, you're not really educated in the true sense. And Kabir again says it very eloquently. You know, your God will never come to you unless you shed your pride. You need to make room. If you have pride in you, if you have vanity, there's no room for your God to come. And so you're not really going to be educated. So I emphasize again and again, incidentally, Gandhi himself had no university qualification. It's a misconception that folks have about Gandhi having a university qualification. He didn't. He qualified as a barrister. But that's not connected with the university system. No, wasn't then, at least. So his only qualification was a school certification. And Gandhi had found his calling in life very early on. Truth resonated within and he caught hold of that. And his whole life is nothing but a journey in quest of that truth. His autobiography is entitled The Story of My Experiments with Truth. And man, if he wasn't educated, who was? I keep repeating this. There are others, you know, Michael Faraday is the greatest scientist of his time in the whole world. Had not had any formal education beyond the second grade in school. Nothing more than that. And he went on to become the greatest scientist of his time and one of the great ones of all times. Mendel was in no university system. The work that he did had no connection. Incidentally, Mendel was trying hard to qualify as a school teacher. Very hard. And much after he had made this fundamental discovery that has altered the course of mankind, he failed to qualify as a school teacher in a qualifying examination. We need to think about this business of forever being obsessed with certifying, with putting down things on paper. This supreme genius has been failed by this ordinary mundane examination. They didn't accept him. He couldn't become a school teacher. And Einstein, for that matter, nobody in Einstein's life, incidentally, ever said he's going to be Einstein till he became Einstein. No one could see that. So much for university systems that are supposed to nurture talent. I cannot think of a single person in the formal system, those associated with Einstein. I'm not his biographer. But whatever I've read about him, no one could. Three of the greatest mysteries of nature were solved by him away from university systems. He was patent clerk third class at Bern in the patent office there. Incidentally, after he had done that, solved three of the greatest mysteries of nature, he attempted to improve his standing there from patent clerk third class to patent clerk second class, and he failed the exam. I again tell you, we need to think about this. There's a purpose for me to repeatedly say that. There are numerous examples like that. I'm not trying to run down university systems, don't get me wrong. All I want is that collectively and individually, we must reflect on this. These are people who changed society, the names that I recounted before you. They've changed the world, they've changed the course of mankind. They brought about change for benefit, for welfare, for good. But university systems haven't seemed to have done much with them or had much to do with what they did. And so we need to reflect a little bit and see whether we could do something about that. That's the purpose of my talk today. And what did Mark Twain say? Remember, he said, I did not allow my schooling to interfere with my education. I re-emphasize the point again and again, again and again. Cannot seem to get out of this obsession with trying to emphasize my point. But it helps me become a little more focused on this. So what must universities do then? I'm not saying that universities throw out everything. That's not the point. But yes, a certain degree of introspection in a radical way. Introspection. I'm not asking us to destroy everything. I'm not asking that we throw away everything. But radical introspection is certainly required in today's time. I hark back to my theme. What should we introspect about? Are we really providing a platform to each individual who enrolls with us? A platform, an opportunity to delve within and seek that drumbeat and then march in the world in harmony with that. And if we do that sincerely, we'll find many answers. I worry about this because in my own university, through my own experiences, I realized that there were certainly many good experiences. I'm not running down things, but there were many that weren't. And we could do some things with that. That's what I believe. We must somewhere get students to then be inspired, to be driven. You know, once you discover your religion, and by the way, the word in Sanskrit for religion is dharma. Literally translated, it means that which binds you, that which holds you. And so students must then be inspired by their dharma, by that which binds them. They must be propelled by that. And one of the best ways to do that, in my limited experience that I have, and there must be other ways, but one of the really effective ways is to get students, to get young minds to be acquainted with the challenges of society, with the challenges of the real world. Kabir, incidentally, was gripped by them. So was Mahatma Gandhi, so was Ramakrishna Paramahansa, so was the Buddha, so was Christ, so was Faraday. They were all gripped by the challenges of society that existed in their times. Nothing like that for young minds to be driven, to be able to delve within, find their calling, and then move in the real world for those challenges. It has proved so effective in my limited experience. My colleagues and I over the last 15 years, 20 years, have experimented on this in many ways, and it's proved very, very effective. And so I hark back to this. So we want students to do this. Universities must recognize that to a large extent and give students an opportunity to seek their calling through these challenges. There is so much idealism in youth. And when you're young, there is this spirit. There is this spirit for adventure. There is this readiness to accept the new. Change is not easy as you grow older. And I don't mean physically old. Mahatma Gandhi was in his late 70s and forever not only driving change, but seeking change within. Every single living moment of his life, Gandhi was changing and evolving for the better. Consistently. If you read Gandhi carefully, and there are so many studies on him, you will realize every single moment of his life he was changing. So it doesn't have much to do with physical age. It's a certain ossification in the processes by which we believe things or accept things. And I remember from long ago, when I was a student here in England, I came across Attenborough's Life on Earth on television before I bought that book, which was published later. And he speaks of this island in Japan where there were a bunch of monkeys. It's a tourist place, and there were monkeys that lived on that island and spent most of the time on the beach there.